Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by a panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Bruno Barron, Philip Beverly, Marge Halperin, and Jeannie Ives. Our program tonight, coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email me a comment, it's Bruce Dumont at museum.tv. If you want to tweet me a comment or a question, it's at Dumo, at D-U-M-O. And, of course, you can join us on the World Wide Web, audio and video, Beyond the Beltway. Every uttered word carried around the world on beyondthebeltway.com. We have exactly 365 days to Election Day. 1 year from now, we're going to know pretty much the polls will be closing very shortly, 365 days, and of course, there's 85 days to go before real voters actually offer an opinion other than what they've been offering to the pollsters. And again, we'll be talking about the campaign. We'll be talking about the problems of Ben Carson, Marco Rubio, as well as what's happening in the Republican and Democratic primaries. Again, we're going to push that a little bit down in our discussion this evening, because, frankly, I think there's a bigger issue to discuss, and that is the death of 224 Russians on a plane from Egypt back to Russia. And there was an explosion. There was instant credit that was taken, or claims of credit, by ISIS. No one is officially locked in that it was them. But again, the issue of air safety is thrust back into the headlines around the world. And Jeannie Ives, I want to thank you. You're one of our Republicans of the night. Does this what does this mean if ISIS was really involved in this?
It means that they have stepped up their game and they've taken it to a whole new level, and that we need to be concerned about air safety once again in the United States, especially with the Thanksgiving holiday coming up with the busiest travel time. And, you know, I was just on a flight Friday and Saturday morning, and I'll be honest with you, it's a little bit haphazard how they do pre-screening or not pre-screening. All that concerns you, because as the lines get thicker, you're headed into the already pre-screened. So I wonder about it all the time.
Philip Beverly, one of our Democrats this evening. Philip, what's your reaction?
This is going to be expensive for airports around the world, because I think the United States, as Jeannie says, and we're better than a lot of places in the world in terms of how we go through screening and security generally. I'm very concerned that if they can get a national flag carrier of another country and destroy it.
The first wave of information that came out about this was thought that maybe it was ground crew, somewhere in the ground, that maybe the passengers were not the problem, even though they were taking off from Egypt. Your reaction, Bruno Barron, one of our other guests this
week. I'm just surprised that an airliner can be taken down by the JV team. Maybe they're not the JV team, and maybe that, you know, kind of utterance shouldn't have been said. But it's you have to step back a little bit and realize that this is Egypt and not the United States of America, and it's a Russian airliner. And not that, I mean, you know, it's like Russian airliners fall out of the sky in Russia all the time. So you're always wondering about mechanical problems, the age of the airplanes and all these other kind of things. So there's a whole network of things that are probably easier to accomplish by flights going out of the Middle East than there are to accomplish going out of an American airport on an American airline. It's really simple.
Am I hearing you say that you think it might not be a bomb?
No, what I'm saying is that here in the United States, as much as we worry about heavy travel seasons and all the other things that are going on, I would be surprised if we weren't a little bit safer than you were getting on a Russian airliner flying out of Egypt.
Marge Halperin also joins us this evening, a Democrat. Marge, nice to have you with us on Beyond the Beltway. What's your take on this particular issue?
This might be the closest I come to agreeing with Bruno all night long, so pay attention.
Surprise.
But I also agree it's a good idea to step back. This is just the kind of story where we're frantic to find out what happened. We're frantic to make judgment, to make an assumption, to figure out how we can learn. And really, as Jeannie said, you want to know what the lessons are so we can all be sure we're safe. But there are a whole lot of facts missing. What was the access? If it was a bomb, and there's a lot of people who think it was, We don't know yet. What was the access? Was it a breach there within that airline, within that airport, within their own security force? What are the things that made that possible that we can learn from? And speculating about that is not a useful enterprise.
Jeannie?
Oh, well, you know, I think that we have to find out immediately what happened. And I'm heartened that the FBI is actually on the ground, apparently assisting in discovering.
Requested by the Russians.
Good for them. Maybe we can have some cooperation when they're under attack and can feel like what we had for 9/11. Maybe this is their 9/11, as somebody else had said earlier. They should wake up to the fact that they're vulnerable, too, to the same threats that we are. And there's not a single country who isn't vulnerable to this type of threat. That's why the U.S., when they have backed off of leadership in the international scene, this is what happens when you don't have a powerful country in charge of the security for really the rest of the world.
Are the Russians more vulnerable today because they have entered the military fray in Syria, Bruno? Is that part of this?
Clearly. They've made themselves a target. And because they've made themselves a target, they are putting themselves in a position where an organization like ISIS, which probably has, you know, contacts, they've got contacts in Libya, they've got networks in Libya, Yemen. Yes, they're mostly Syria and Iraq, but then you've got the Russians are very vulnerable in the Chechen situation. So you have, not only are they vulnerable, but they are actually, once the attention is turned toward them, you can make the case that they're even more vulnerable than we are.
But does that bring them more aggressively, to be fighting ISIS? Because some of the criticism of the Russians so far is they've been spending all their time fighting, you know, the Assad enemies in Syria, not necessarily focusing on the ones we would like them to focus on, which is ISIS. Does this bring them closer to the United States and some of the West in zeroing in on ISIS as the real enemy? Is this their wake-up call?
I think it would be from the American perspective, but they still have whatever agenda that they have vis-a-vis Syria, and apparently that's keeping Assad in power to the detriment of
but
the country.
But with 224 dead Russians, it seems to me that maybe there is some greater demand and pressure on Putin to maybe react in a different way. I mean, like any politician anywhere, he can react to pressure that comes from his people.
I'm not sure he's like any politician anywhere.
Exactly.
Are the people different? I mean, do you think that the outpouring of grief and anger and frustration that 224 families in Russia are going through is really that much different than what would happen if 224 Americans were killed?
I do.
I think the environment in which they express their grief is very different.
Yes. Mm-hmm. All right, go ahead.
I would agree. I mean, I don't think that they have Putin is not necessarily democratically elected like our leaders are, and neither are his sub-leaders. He controls that country very tightly. I mean, who knows what other aggressive forces might have banded together to take Putin out in this way or to cause the tragedy to him. Look, he's invaded Ukraine. The Russians apparently shot down that other plane from Malaysia. So, I mean, he's got some problem people around the globe that he has really honked off. And who knows who's not working together to kind of put this in his.
When we come back, I want to talk about one of the issues that's been brought up, and that is, what about all the people who work on planes? How extensive is the background checks on those people? Many of them are third world employees.
Excuse me, Chad. Here is a flash from the Associated Press, Dateline Dallas. Two priests who were with President Kennedy say he is dead of bullet wounds.
It was a moment that defined American history. But what really happened in Dallas that day? And does that tragedy lead back to Chicago? A new play, Assassination Theater, answers that question. Now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. For tickets, go to assassinationtheater.com.
The beauty of Amlink's interior landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlinks now at 888-880-TREE. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago picking up our conversation where we left off, and that is the early report suggesting that it may be, have been someone in the crew, either the crew on the tarmac or someone involved in working, catering, whatever the case may be, in the flight that ended in the lives of 224 Russians. Philip Beverly, where does one start to try to do a better job around the world, not just in the United States, about checking the backgrounds of people who do have the access to those flights? Because we know there's recruitment out there. There's massive recruitment going on all over the world in all countries for young men and women to turn against their or I don't want to say against their beliefs, to try to bring down the West.
That's a tough thing, because we're fighting an ideology. We're fighting an idea that is in direct opposition to the ideals that we hold here in the West. And from what I understand from some pretty intense examination from the intelligence side, you can hide people. And they're not sleepers exactly, but there are people that look, appear, act, behave, function every day, and you never know that they're actually participating in anti-West activities.
Okay. So they're spies. They're spies who have a more immediate desire to kill you as opposed to fight an ideology. Marge?
Well, look at the Boston bombing, if you want to know. The access to technology, yeah, wasn't even very high tech. You know, high tech as an approach, but the ability to infiltrate, if you will, you know, a major event and a major activity, risking thousands of lives, that's out there. It's out on the internet, both in terms of recruiting or indoctrinating people who are here on the ground or can be on the ground. It's out there in terms of the technology to build some very dangerous weaponry. That isn't going to change. I'm sitting here in front of a, you know, tech that I can't even figure out, my new Surface here. But if I dig in here, I'm not the high-tech person. But anyone who has that access is going to find it, and it's getting easier and easier all the time. So what are the security measures we can take that are short of the drastic limits to personal freedoms that the Bush administration tried, but that will more effectively get at what we need
and
to
again,
get
at? And again, we could be absolutely perfect in the way that we vet those that work at our airports, but that has nothing to do with the flights that are coming in to this country.
Well,
and yet you've made the point that Egypt is one of the better countries in the world, allegedly, insofar as its internal security is concerned.
Well, and really, who really knows? I mean, I would imagine the country that's probably best with internal security is Israel.
Right.
Yes.
And, you know, for obvious reasons. The fact is that the best security in the world can be defeated by something they don't see coming. And we learned that on 9/11. We kind of learned it on with the Boston bombing, and the only thing we can really do. The question becomes: Can this ideology, in any way, shape, or form, damage and/or destroy our way of life or our civilization? And the only way that they can do that is that they force us into an error that makes our civilization less livable. They cannot win long term. So the first thing that our side has to do is just simply don't panic, and then we just step back and work as clearly as we can to defeat them, not just from one angle, but from every angle we can find to defeat them.
Does this incident, I want to go back to a question I alluded to in the first segment, does this incident represent an opportunity for a much more expansive involvement of the countries of the world, not just the West, in fighting ISIS, including Russia, China, and a variety of other countries that are, at the moment are somewhat, you know, on the sidelines?
Oh, you know, I'd be interested in finding out what Israel knows about what happened in Egypt, because I think that their intelligence is far more sophisticated than almost anybody else in that region, including the United States. And so I think if we look to that, you know, maybe they can cooperate in terms of an intelligence standpoint. And going further, I think that we do have an opportunity here to maybe bring together some folks and really batter ISIS or ISIL and find out who their leaders are and take them out. I think that's one thing that's I find very difficult to understand. We talk about ISIS. We talk about ISIL. Does anybody know who's really in charge of that gang? I mean, with Al-Qaeda, we kind of pointed to Osama bin Laden. We kind of had an idea of what was going on there with the Taliban. They have their factions and their leaders, which we have an idea about who they are and what they stand for. Hamas, we know who's ahead of Hamas and everything like that. Who's actually leading them?
But if they all have a single goal, I guess the question is it really important to know exactly who they are if they have a similar goal?
Yes, because leadership matters. You take out the leadership and you can turn things. If you don't identify who that leadership is and you don't target them and take them out, you got to put these people in disarray. And leadership is key to keeping them in formation and doing what they say.
Speaking of leadership, you were making a comment during the break that the leadership of the congressional leadership of our intelligence operation in the United States, members of Congress in charge of the respective House and Senate committees, they were on television today, and you were reading through the lines, and you don't think that they were telling us
They're all hedging their bet. Well, we're 90% sure that it's probably a bomb. It's more likely than not that it was a bomb. This is based on, I guess, the satellite imagery that show the flash of light. It's based on, reports on the ground, intelligence. I think when they're going that far and telling us that they think it was a bomb, I think they know that it's a bomb. That's my gut feeling, because they have special intelligence that we don't have, and certainly the media doesn't
have.
And
ISIS took claim almost immediately.
Yeah, but
is that a recruitment effort on their part?
It could be, and it's most, again, it's more likely than not that ISIS is responsible, and ISIS has a reason to go after Russia at this point, so this is where they can prove that they've actually done something. I'm not really sure that second guessing all that kind of stuff. Then you just got to ask, how did they get a bomb on an airplane, and can they do it elsewhere?
But Bruce, the question that you just asked about the other countries sort of banding together to fight the idea, I don't trust the Russians, and there seems to be the possibility of another agenda in play where their footprint in the region actually gets larger, at the expense of, say, our footprint in the region. And they're being self-interested. They're going to look to satisfy their own interests, which means sort of pushing us out. I think that causes more instability in the region than stability.
There are already reports, albeit they are internet reports, that the Russians are about to begin, or some with Russian connections are about to begin, to say that maybe the CIA was behind this.
Well, I think what Philip brings up is also an interesting point, considering that we're now apparently going to put 50 special forces soldiers in play in that region to help the situation.
Dianne Feinstein, the Democrat from California, said today was not enough.
Sure, she said it was not enough. And then Kristen Gillibrand, from the senator from New York, said, I don't think that we should put the 50 in without the president first coming to Congress and asking for authorization. She thinks it's going too far. So I think that's an interesting dichotomy, two different senators, different coasts, different feelings.
What do you think? You're a Democrat.
I'm a Democrat who isn't going to rule on how many military personnel to send.
Smart move.
Where exactly. But I would like to say two things to catch up a little bit to these last comments that went around the table. First of all, in terms of knowing who runs ISIS, it may not be the same as a bin Laden structure, but it was just like 2 weeks ago where the number two in command was killed by the U.S. in an airstrike. So it's not like we don't have any idea who's doing this. You know, they have a list of targets from the U.S. it's going after systematically and successfully. But I would also like to say, sort of in summary, in answer to an earlier question you had, Bruce, that with the FBI apparently on the ground helping and participating, with the kinds of conversations that are happening, one impact I'd like to see this have is to help the international coalition become stronger. Maybe I'm in a little bit of a fantasy land, but if this turns out to be a reason for us to work more productively with Russia, right now that'd be a really good thing.
Right.
And I would hope
this could evolve into a world war against ISIS.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I'm a little bit skeptical of that. First of all, none of us really knows. I think we all agree that that this radicalism as an idea is somewhat dangerous and can kill people in virtually any country at will, if and when they want to, depending on what kind of bomb or what kind of terrorism they use. Is ISIS, this small rump state made up of pieces of Syria and pieces of Iraq, a big enough threat to mobilize a coalition against? I think the answer to that is yes, if you have something that goes – I mean, we all know that the West, whether it's the United States of America under Bush or whatever, Russia is not really the West but close enough, that we know that they can militarily defeat a small faction anywhere, any place, once they really need to. The question is, what do they do after they defeat this entity? And that's been the hardest part to actually fix. So I think – I mean, let's put it this way. This is all connected to, you've got this massive refugee problem going on in Europe right now. People are leaving. I think there's elements in ISIS and in the Middle East that are using this refugee crisis to actually send fighters into Europe. And we don't even know what's going to happen a year from now, 2 years from now, 6 months from now with the people that are the whole refugee situation. So this is a pretty big problem. The question is, how do you solve these things when you have an American leader that literally wants to deflate and kind of create power vacuums where the United States has been in and actually back away from things and then expect Europe and Russia and countries like this that are under tremendous pressure and actually don't have much of a leadership agenda to actually solve problems?
Well, you ask an interesting question, which leads to our next discussion when we come back, and that is, who is going to be the next leader? Because this one's a lame duck. Let's talk about what the next one might be and who it might be when we come back from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont.
This is Larry King at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Tonight, we've got a special guest for you to meet. What do you like to do as a kid?
I like to play baseball. I like to watch television.
What was your favorite sports team?
Sports team growing up was the St. Louis Cardinals.
What was your favorite vacation?
I think the vacation we went to New York City to the World's Fair, see Yankee Stadium.
Who was your childhood hero?
Childhood hero, probably Hopalong Cassidy.
What was your biggest fear growing up?
My biggest fear probably was that I would irritate my father.
What's the silliest thing you've ever done?
Irritated my father.
Give the gift of Larry King. Order your gift certificate now at museum.tv. That's museum.tv. Guggenheim back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. At this point, we let all of our guests introduce themselves, and we start tonight with Marge Halperin. Marge?
Good evening. I'm a communications and public affairs consultant here in Chicago. I'm also a Democratic analyst for the WGN-TV Morning News in Chicago, and politically trained, started my political work in 1989 on the Rich Daley campaign with David Axelrod, Rahm Emanuel, David Wilhelm, and some other names you would
know. I've
heard
of those people. Bruno Behrend.
I'm Bruno Behrend. I'm a senior fellow at the Heartland Institute, primarily on education issues. I'm also a co-founder of an organization called American Transparency, which operates the Open the Books online database, where we want to put every dime of government money in the United States of America, state, local, and federal, online for a searchable in a searchable format.
Philip Beverly.
I'm an associate professor of political science at Chicago State University and general enfant terrible at my university.
Jeannie Ives.
Hi, I'm Jeannie Ives. I'm a Republican state representative out of the Wheaton area, and I'm a mother of five children.
If you want to count negative publicity or negative coverage, you'd have to say that last week was a bad week for Ben Carson, who, depending on which poll you're looking at, is the front runner for the Republican presidential nomination.
I disagree.
Now, I believe that many of conservative persuasions believe that any knock by the national news media only helps you. But again, it's never good to be playing defense. And so I want to talk about some of the issues that Ben Carson has been dealing with this past week, mostly about his biography, mostly about questions in that biography as to whether or not they're truthful or not. And again, he was on television today saying that one of the reasons why the media is against him and ganging up on him and vetting him at a level that no candidate has ever been vetted before. And this is what he had to say, quote, "I am a threat to the progressives, the secular progressive movement in this country. I'm a very big threat because they can look at the polling data and they can see that I'm the candidate who's most likely to be able to beat Hillary Clinton." End of quote. Now, Philip Beverly, what is your take on Ben Carson and whether or not he is being treated unfairly by the news media?
Welcome to politics, Ben Carson. This is how it is. You're being scrutinized because you're running for president of the United States. All credible candidates will go through a microscopic examination of everything that they've ever said or done. There's no surprise here. And if he's wanting to move on from it, go back into retirement.
Bruno Behrend.
I did see a very, very funny quip on Twitter today saying that he's the first black candidate for president who's actually had his academic records looked at. And I thought that was actually kind of funny, given how Barack Obama's academic records were and still are unviewable. But leaving the quips aside, funny and accurate as they are, Ben Carson is not going to be the nominee. He is not going to win. He might win some delegates. He's not going to win the primary. I generally think that if this is like if and I don't know all the details of all the different things that have been going on, but if you're going to write a book that says that you almost got into West Point and that you did this at one point in time and did that another point in time, that stuff is going to be fact checked, especially if you're a Republican. The fact of the matter is, and we can discuss media bias in detail or not in detail, but you get a pass if you are the first black candidate for president from the Democratic Party or if you're the first woman president. There are things you can say or do that you don't have to worry about getting vetted. If you're a Republican, you're going to get vetted 10 ways to Sunday, and you just can't put anything even remotely puffing in your biography and not expect it to be fact checked.
I think the Republicans have figured out in the last debate that it's always beneficial to attack the media. So I'm not surprised you say that, but I strongly disagree. The first question Hillary had at the last debate was giving a record of her statements on Keystone and some other things and saying, will you just say anything to get elected? I don't think that's giving her a pass. You look at the history of coverage that she's had, even as first lady. She mentions cookies and she's, snowed under with an onslaught.
Why was she not asked one question about the potential conflict between the Clinton Global Initiative and her job as Secretary of State? Well, wouldn't that be a more relevant thing to say that, as opposed to just this litany of things where she flip-flopped on? Why was she not asked about anything?
Can you find harsher questions than she was asked? No doubt you can,
yes,
especially
absolutely.
You, Bruce.
Absolutely.
But I could find some harsher questions for any of the Republicans than they were asked that
so
day,
could
too.
We
all could. The point is, each of them will be scrutinized, as Phil said, and they should be scrutinized. That's what a campaign is for. I'd like to hear all of the candidates explain things that they've put out, positions, and their personal stories, so we can really know them well enough.
Well, you know, here's the interesting thing.
Speak to the Ben Carson answer first, if you will.
Okay, so Ben Carson is being attacked because, let's face it, last quarter he raised more money than any other GOP candidate. He raised $20.8 million in that quarter alone. Now, he's also risen in the polls. In fact, they had him number one in Iowa. So all of a sudden now we're going to hyperventilate on some of the details that he came out with his life story. And, oh, by the way, as a West Point graduate and my son who's at West Point and my other son who got accepted but declined, I understand the West Point admissions process.
What is it?
And it's more than likely. Well, it's very detailed now. It's probably different back from when Ben Carson went.
Well, he said he was offered a scholarship.
And I have no doubt that he probably was offered a scholarship. They looked at him. They looked at his record and said, you are a shoo-in. Base, and they have racial preferences there too as well. They probably said, we can get you in there, and it's a fully funded scholarship, because they don't talk in terms of, you know, everything's paid for. They call it a scholarship. Well, there's a commitment behind that scholarship to serve your country.
But there's no doubt he was offered it in this particular case. When you have candidates who have track records of, you know, elected office. Or you've been the head of Hewlett-Packard. You have a track record. Or you're a mogul like Donald Trump. You have all kinds of track records because of your activities. Ben Carson, first and foremost, we know that he's a great, you know, neurosurgeon. Everybody knows that. Nobody doubts that. But the rest of his foundation, if you will, it's all based on his bio. It's based on a belief that this is a quintessential up from a bootstrap story, a great story. It's made into a motion picture. A great story, but the question is, if that's the key of your foundation, then you have to be prepared to, defend it,
Bruce,
and vouch for.
Here's the deal. There's
true.
Nothing to defend about what he said, and that's why they're nitpicking. And I don't understand their bias. Their bias is because he's now in front runner status in Iowa. Now, oh, by the way, this really didn't hurt Ben Carson. He raised $3.5 million
I don't think.
And that's because the people, the real people, once we get out of this bubble that we're in sometimes in politics, they know that he's an authentic individual, and they're looking for authenticity.
And you know what? If I walked into a hospital wanting to just be a neurosurgeon, because it sounds kind of cool, even though I have no experience at all in medicine, I would be laughed out of the building. And I don't know why we treat politics as some lesser sort of institution that any amateur can show up and think that they can be president of the United States.
Because because people present themselves, and then the voters get a chance to make the decision as to whether someone has credibility or not. I mean, he in all the polls, he is the most admired and he is the most trusted person on the ballot.
That's why I'd like to see, is it false?
I mean, yes. He has that, but are these legitimate questions?
No.
If he fudged his bios, I mean, isn't that fair game?
I have to say that the West Point story doesn't bother me very much. It was a long time ago. If he was off on his date, the issue of whether free tuition is a scholarship or not is semantics. I'm with you on that, actually, Jeannie. But the pyramids built by Joseph for grain, there's only like this little hole in them. He's pretty out there on science, despite his credentials as a neurologist. He's pretty out there on science and a lot of other things that are extremely troubling to me. But I would like to clear up one other thing, Jeannie. I can't speak for the media, and if you think the media is coming from a liberal leftist place, that's a place I know well enough to speak from. And let me just say, if Ben Carson is going to be the strongest candidate you can put forward, Bring him on. I'd love to see him run against Hillary.
I'm with Bruno. I'm not sure he makes the nomination. I'm just saying he's in front runner status now. And that's why the media is picking up and trying to find something that's wrong with him. Because, you know, he does have this incredible story and he's accomplished. You can't pick apart his neurosurgeon credentials and what he's been able to do to save
he's
babies.
Not running to be a neurosurgeon.
That's not what he's
that shows a particular
he's beating her in head-to-head polls.
He's beating her in head-to-head polls, and that is one reason why you can look at his book and you can pull everything apart. What I think is fascinating here is that a person's, and I put this up on Facebook arguing with Dave Lundy, who's been on this show quite often, the fact that he thinks that the pyramids were used to store grain, it clearly didn't prevent him from being a brilliant brain surgeon and wouldn't prevent him from being a great president, possibly. At the end
I don't know.
And that's our bias. Our bias is that every person who runs for president has to toe there's a certain set of party lines that everybody has to toe, and if they don't toe it, they're not qualified. And quite frankly, I don't know that. When I look at a presidential candidate, I want to look at their principles, and I want to see if those principles will lead them to pick the right people to make the right decisions. And Ben Carson may or may not qualify under those rubrics. But my primary viewpoint, and I say this both about Trump and Carson, who are leading as non-politicians from two different angles, at the end of the day, when the voting starts, the Republican Party picks somebody electable.
I'd like to see them have a toehold on reality. That would be a criteria for me.
Then you need a reality show host. You need someone steeped in the experience of reality shows. 1-800-723-8029. When we come back, I want to hear from you about Ben Carson, and we're going to talk more about him and Donald Trump.
The beauty of Amlink's interior landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlings now at 888-880-TREE.
Excuse me, Chet. Here is a flash from the Associated Press, Dateline Dallas. Two priests who were with President Kennedy say he is dead of bullet wounds.
It was a moment that defined American history. But what really happened in Dallas that day? And does that tragedy lead back to Chicago? A new play, Assassination Theater, answers that question. Now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. For tickets, go to assassinationtheater.com. We'll be right back. We're back. I want to follow up on a question, line of questioning with you, Philip, and that is what Ben Carson said. He says that he's a threat to the progressives and the secular progressive movement in this country. And I had this discussion, you know, when Herman Cain was running, and Herman Cain was leading the Republican PAC a few years ago. And that is this. If Ben Carson were to become the Republican nominee, I would assume that the number of African Americans who might consider voting for a Republican, Ben Carson, is a larger number than the Republican Party has probably had going for it in a long, long time.
No.
You disagree with that?
It's not going to happen.
Tell me why I'm wrong.
Ben Carson is a great story in the African American community. Great sort of professional role model, work hard, study, go to school, you can be a brain surgeon kind of thing. Voting for him to be president of the United States isn't necessarily going to be in part of that conversation. I think black voters are astute enough to vote their interest and not just because a candidate's black.
Well, let's talk about their interest. There's a lot of very religious African Americans in this country.
Absolutely.
They believe everything that Ben Carson speaks about. They believe in the power
everything?
Many of the things. But let me focus on point. They probably agree with him in a significant way that is part of his story, is that one of the reasons why he turned away from a difficult life that was going to lead him nowhere is because he found Jesus Christ. And when candidates talk about finding, you know, Jesus Christ and talking in a religious way, or found God, I should say, not Jesus Christ specifically, there's a lot of African Americans who believe that. They go to church every single Sunday. They hear people talking about religious, not government related things. They think about things, how a spiritual awakening has affected and changed one man's life. So I'm not so sure, and I think we would all agree, not all blacks are liberals, and not all blacks are progressives. Would you acknowledge that?
I would acknowledge that, and they're conversely not conservatives, and not going to vote for a party that has time and again shown that it does not have their interest at heart.
I think what Philip's bringing up here is the fact that we have not reached out to that community to prove to them
right.
that really free enterprise, conservative ideals, school choice primarily, really are issues that the black community would support had they been messaged to them correctly. They want opportunity. They need opportunity, especially in what we've seen with Chicago. And I know one black pastor in particular, Pastor Corey Brooks, who's been trying to do a lot in the black community with conservatives and bringing them around to our principles.
I think there's messages, and there's, I think that Phil is probably correct that it's not so much the color of the person, and it might have something to do with, you know, Ben Carson being black. It probably has less to do with what his message might be or the authenticity, and then also how believable he is in other things. I mean, let's put it this way: picking up 2 or 3% of the black vote relative to its usual 95%, but losing whole swaths of the middle isn't going to do the Republican Party much good if they don't think he's a believable candidate. But what is far more, and this goes to what Jeannie is saying, what Matt Bevin in Kentucky did with spending the last week of the campaign campaigning entirely in poor black neighborhoods with his black female military running mate, that's something that might put a little bit of fear into the Democrats. Look, the Democratic Party on paper, if you look at all of its programs and all the things like more money for this and more money for that, you can say that that's in the African American community's interest as long as everybody's kept dependent, as long as everybody's kept poor, as long as everybody's kept on the liberal plantation, that sounds like it's in their interest. But if you say, here's an alternative vision, where you're not just caving into everything and saying, oh, we'll try and do a bidding war with the Democrats, but saying, here's some real opportunity, here's some business, here's a better education system. Dumping more money into urban districts has a 50-year track record of failure. Why are we doing it?
Here's the opportunity. We're going to give more money to corporate interests. We're going to put more money into rich people's hands, and it'll trickle down to you, and you'll have jobs, but we're not going to raise your minimum wage because they're not going to be good-paying jobs. Take a look at Texas.
That's a fair critique for some of what's advocated by the Republican Party. It is not a fair critique of what is advocated by others in the Republican Party.
That's what happened. We're in the heart of the Midwest. That's what happened in Ohio. That's what happened in Indiana, Wisconsin, Kentucky. Texas started it.
Bruno,
well,
you said earlier in the program that Rubio is one of the guys on your list.
He's one of them who can win a general.
Okay.
It's not a guarantee that he can win the general.
And the problems we had last week, his credit card issues, are not going to last long.
Well, I don't know if they're going to last long or not. Like I said, it's a little bit unfair. I actually quipped on about this earlier today. I said that what Marco Rubio should say is that, yeah, when I was struggling, I had some issues where credit card things got jumbled. I didn't have somebody who could give me a $1,000 commodity investment and turn it into $100,000 like Hillary Clinton did in the past. And we all know that was something shady. We all know it. So the fact of the matter is that there's always more scrutiny for these kinds of things for Republicans, and they do have – it is a double standard, and it is something they do have to worry about.
But here's the scrutiny.
The number of people who have had credit card problems over the years, especially in that age group, that's a big voting block.
So, Rubio – like I said, Rubio is one of the candidates who is – believable enough and moderate enough and palatable enough to the entire nation. And the three that I've put on the table are Jeb Bush, John Kasich, and Marco Rubio.
I disagree with that. And the three I put on the list, Rubio's been on the list for the beginning. I added Donald Trump to that list, and I added Hillary Clinton to the list. But the question is, who can be the next president of the United States? Those are the three.
Well,
one of those three will be the next president of the United States.
Trump cannot win a general election.
I don't believe it'll be Rubio because the guy doesn't even want the job that he has now. And so at the first crisis, is he going to fold?
There's 100 senators that want to be the president of the United States. 100 of them. There's only a few running right now.
Philip, somebody of your stature and intellect should really not use silly Jeb Bush talking points. Rubio answered that question in the last debate, and he answered it so well it wasn't even funny. Barack Obama missed all his votes. Hillary Clinton missed all their votes. Gillibrand missed all their votes. Many more votes than Rubio did. That's a nothing issue.
Are you headed to Los Angeles? Looking for the ideal place for you and your family to relax and enjoy yourselves? A place that combines a Four Diamond Hotel experience with a convenient location? It's the Hilton Los Angeles Universal City, just steps away from Universal Studios Hollywood, CityWalk, and NBC Studios. Just a short ride to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, TCL Chinese Theater, Warner Brothers, and other popular attractions. Enjoy spacious rooms offering breathtaking views and a world-class Las Vegas-style seafood and prime rib buffet every weekend and holidays. Share family fun and enjoy the oasis of the palm tree-lined pool and whirlpool. Relax in your own private poolside cabana with a cocktail or snack at your fingertips. Book your reservation today at HiltonUniversal.com or call 1-800-774-1500. The Hilton Los Angeles Universal City at HiltonUniversal.com. They let you be the star in Hollywood.
The beauty of Amlinks Interior Landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlinks now at 888-880-TREE.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be, where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
Excuse me, Chet. Here is a flash from the Associated Press, Dateline Dallas. Two priests who were with President Kennedy say he is dead of bullet wounds.
It was a moment that defined American history. But what really happened in Dallas that day? And does that tragedy lead back to Chicago? A new play, Assassination Theater, answers that question. Now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. For tickets, go to assassinationtheater.com. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Tonight featuring commentary by Bruno Barron, Philip Beverly, Marge Halperin, and Jeannie Ives. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Toll-free lines open at 1-800-723-8289. And if you would like to email me a comment, it's brucedumont@museum.t. If you want to tweet me a comment, it's @Dumo. And we're going to take a moment out of the regular discussion here and bring into our guest a young man who was a guest on this program actually a couple of times over the last several months. And he is going to be our sort of social media analyst because he spends a large portion of his life on Facebook and also on Twitter. And Bernard Sue joins us from his home in New York City. Bernard, nice to have you with us.
Thanks, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
Now, let me ask you this question, because you're very politically astute, and people who've heard you on this program know that to be the case. But as you look at the broad social media sphere of influence that's out there, what are the basic high points that the general public should know about what's really happening on social media? And is there one particular party that's doing it better than another party?
Well, hands down, the Democratic Party is, and pretty much the liberals, have squashed any kind of conservative rhetoric, any kind of conservative narrative that would even exist. I mean, just look as far back as 2008, which is ancient in social media timelines, and the Barack Obama campaign. And I'm going to tell you that probably part of his success is because of his social media dominance.
Now, what about in the Republican primary? It seems to me that much of Donald Trump's popularity comes from that he spends more time than anybody else tweeting his comments. Where does he fit into the bigger, broader picture?
You know, he's a very popular following on Twitter, but it's very strange, because when you go on Twitter and you look at his tweets, I mean, the numbers on there are spectacular. You have thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of favorites and retweets on anything that he posts. But then if you read some of the comments, it's all hate against him, which, you know, it might play into the problem of having spam on social media. But then the other thing, too, so with his Saturday Night Live appearance last night, there was so many negative posts about Trump. You could hardly ever find one post that was, you know, talking about the great numbers that Trump was going to get for Saturday Night Live. And but the problem is that when you read the comments on these posts that come from these big name, you know, media conglomerates, all these posts are actually for Trump. So you have this kind of opposite. Whoever posts something, you're going to get comments opposite of it. It's actually a very strange dichotomy that exists.
When you look at those, at your colleagues, and you're the millennial generation, are they going to vote? I mean, one of the issues is that a lot of young people don't vote. And granted, we have huge turnouts for Bernie Sanders. We were talking about that during the break. But again, how do we know how reliable, you know, the blogosphere and the those that tweet and spend their time on Facebook, how do we know whether they're actually going to show up at the polls? Or do they just want to comment on what's going on?
You know, that's actually a good point, because the millennial generation actually hasn't reached the full maturity of having everybody at voting age. I mean, we're looking at a generation where we're guessing that the last cohorts were born between 2002 and 2004. So not everybody has actually gotten to the point where they're allowed to vote by law. Now, you bring up actually a very important point, because when you go on social media and you see kind of the activist mentality that exists for a lot of people that are, you know, maybe in the older ends of the millennial generation, you'll find that they're all talk. And, you know, they'll have a petition out and say, you know, sign this petition and this whitehouse.gov petition. And, you know, we're going to get some real change. But then you find out, you know, you look at the petition and there's only maybe 100 signatures that are on there. Maybe Jeb Bush could get more people to show up at one of his events than what can these people would sign up for. So it brings you you kind of have to wonder, right, how much of this talk actually gets translated into action. But that's actually one of the things, is because when you look at the rhetoric that gets put out, somebody will take it seriously. You might have a Hillary Clinton that might take it seriously, you know, kind of the social action that some millennials want. Then that's when you need to be scared, or Bernie Sanders, or even a Donald Trump.
Is the key thing at the moment that social media can drive not only traffic to one's website or one's Twitter handle, but also the other issue is that it can drive them to show up at an event. Is that really at the base of Bernie Sanders' appeal? Not only is he saying things that people, young people like, but that generation that he's appealing to, they're all on Twitter. They're all got their Facebook accounts. So if Bernie Sanders is going to show up at some college or university, he can have, you know, 20,000 people there.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you look at on Meet the Press earlier today, Carly Fiorina was talking on there, and she kept advertising her website. And that's one thing that you notice about all these candidates that they're doing now. Like, you know, Ted Cruz shows up on the O'Reilly Factor, and he just keeps telling people to go to, you know, tedcruz.com, you know, trying to get people to donate. And that's kind of the strategy that they're getting at now is, hey, go to my website and donate money. Now, if any one of your audience has actually done business on the internet, you'll find that, you know, this message reaches millions of people, but it could be 1 or 2% that actually take action when it comes to something like donating money. Now, when it comes to events, you know, you could get a Facebook event and invite thousands of people, and you might have a 10% showing rate. So that's kind of how social media works, is that, you know, you can reach a large audience, but the ones who actually take action, it's a very small.
Philip Beverly, I want to ask you, Greg, you're a college professor. Tell us what your students are saying. Are they engaged in this campaign? And what question or comment would you add to Bernard?
No, they're not paying attention. They're not paying attention right now. They're much more interested in what's going on right now. And I think it will pick up as the fields begin to get winnowed down to something more manageable. But they are more immediate. Sort of participation.
And Mark Schauber, let me ask you, as a public relations person, as someone very active in Democratic campaigns and advising, you know, non-candidates as well, I mean, how important is the new media to you, and do most of your candidates get it, or don't they understand it yet?
I think it's crucial. Not only it may not be the strongest fundraising tool, that's true, but I think as a communications tool, that's where things go viral. That's where points of view are formed and go electric through Twitter, through Instagram, Snapchat. There's a lot of other places to go. And I think it will be interesting to watch in the first primary and caucus states what kind of social media campaigns you're seeing there. That's where you're going to, like Phil said, that's where you're going to start to see young people activated.
Bruno Barron.
I have a question for Bernie. You've got you said narrative. What is it about, what is the thing that the Republicans are not doing? I mean, they're clearly spending money on it, and we always know that they like to spend money on the same old consultants that don't do anything. But what needs to be done to get messages out better and faster in terms of narrative, tweets, messages, not necessarily fundraising?
That's the question. We've got to pause for a commercial break, and then we'll be back. 1-800-723-8290. If you have a question for Bernard Hsu, our media expert tonight, give us a call. Social media. Back shortly, and we'll get Bernie's answer from New York. Bye.
So
Excuse me, Chet. Here is a flash from the Associated Press, Dateline Dallas. Two priests who were with President Kennedy say he is dead of bullet wounds.
It was a moment that defined American history. But what really happened in Dallas that day? And does that tragedy lead back to Chicago? A new play, Assassination Theater, answers that question. Now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. For tickets, go to assassinationtheater.com.
The beauty of Amling's interior landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlings now at 888-880-TREE. Back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. And before the break, Bernard Tsui in New York, who's our social media analyst, a question was asked of you by Bruno Behrend as to what can the Republicans do to basically get up to speed in dealing with social media issues. Bernard?
You know, it's actually really strange. So it's kind of like I'm going to respond with kind of a question. It's the same idea of why are there not more conservative comedians and conservative actors, right? I'm not sure what the conservatives can do because a lot of their social viewpoints they're just a losing battle against people that are younger. That's really the only way that you can say it. And, you know, over the break, I had heard Bruno, I think it was Bruno, making a comment about, you know, Ted Cruz is doing the same thing that Obama did in 08 and in 12 for social media. Thing is that social media has changed drastically since 08 and also since 12, too. Even just the web and the internet itself has changed. The thing is that when it comes to narrative, I mean, places like Facebook, I mean, these are liberal supporting companies. And, you know, this is where millennials or anybody on Facebook really are getting their news, and you know they're linking to sites that you know feed off of ad click revenue. You know, you have your garbage sensationalist websites like Vox, Gawker, and Vice Media, right? You know, they sensationalize headlines, they twist the truth just to get people to click. And hey, you know, why don't you look at 10 ads while you're on here, and I divide the story up into 5 different pages.
Jeannie Ives has got a question for you as well, Bernard.
Okay.
Hey, Bernard. You know, I was just curious if you think that social media will have an impact on the Iowa caucuses, particularly will kids be texting back and forth if they plan to attend the caucuses and when they start to move from one camp to another because somebody didn't get a majority vote. Do you think that that's going to have any impact at all with them messaging back and forth and using that type as a way to let's all get over to this guy now instead because our candidate failed in the first round?
You know, possibly. You know, when I think about Iowa and, you know, I've been there once, unfortunately, only once. Just kind of looking at the demographic there, I think it might not have as big an impact compared to like here in New York City. And unfortunately, there's not like a New York City caucus. But over there, I mean, because the communication's instantaneous, you can get a hashtag trending and you can start to change the story, so to say, or the appearance of a story on the internet. But whereas will it change reality? I actually think that a lot of the voters of the Iowa caucus are probably not Twitter users. And if they are, they probably don't post as prolifically as, say, you know, an 18 or a 19-year-old.
I'm guessing that's an East Coast bias.
I am from Chicago, though.
Yeah, well, I think it did play a role in the last election, and it'll play an even stronger role in the next one because everybody's holding their phones. They are on it, and not just millennials, but I think that we'll absolutely see an answer, a positive answer to that question.
Bruno.
Essentially, we're doomed then. I mean, look.
You think there's way too much hype to all this, right?
I think it's an important to not have a strategy and to not look at it and work with it is a stupid mistake.
Right.
But I think that it is not yet as important. And even if it is, and I guess this is just my bias as a conservative, and it's not about social issues or whether I like this or that specific issue. Civilization is serious. It's serious stuff. Who we elect as president and what we do about airliners crashing and what we do about tax policy, that's serious stuff. And if all the serious stuff is boiled down to pointing to shallow, misleading, stupid sites that don't really inform people about anything and that all nuance is gone and that, you know, I mean, one of the big news items that no one's talking about was Ben Sasse's speech his maiden speech to the Senate, where he waited a full year and basically said, "We're doomed. If all we can do is throw bombs at each other across the aisle, we're doomed. And if life comes down to 140 characters of the most insulting, vile 140 characters that we're all shooting at each other, then, you know, I guess maybe we just have to hope that civilization lasts long enough until people's attention spans come back."
Well, I don't know. On the other hand, Twitter has helped spread news when there have been disasters on the planet in various places. There's a lot of great things that can happen in 140 characters.
Not attacking the media.
And I don't know that social media is any different than any other. There's garbage on, I'm sorry to say, on the radio.
There is.
And also in print and lots of other publications. You have to be astute enough to sift through it.
Bernard, what's your answer to that? Speaking for the millennials and those that are addicted to Facebook and Twitter. Are you just looking for fun and games?
You mean for the comment that society's doomed?
Yeah.
Because of this?
It was a little bit hyperbolic, but I think people understand where I'm going.
You know, I actually thought about this. Before, when Saturday Night Live was playing last night, they actually aired like a 1976 episode with Dan Aykroyd and, you know, John Belushi and, you know, the old original
cast. The old
game.
You know,
right? And I was looking at, you know, and I mean, you see the audience, and these were 20-year-old people, and, you know, back then they were born in the 50s, right? So they were probably hippies at the time. And, you know, if you saw kind of how the baby boomer generation changed, right? Every single generation they don't really resemble in their middle age what they were like as children. So, I mean, given how quickly social media changes, at where we are today, I wouldn't be surprised, you know, if in 10 years things look completely different. You know, in 2025, we look back in 15 and we just shake our heads.
Jeannie well, Ives.
That's got to be true because the millennial generation is going through a generation where there's not as much opportunity as what we had when we had a huge industrial base and we had manufacturing jobs that were plentiful, at least in the state of Illinois. And so they've got record student debt. They're looking at still living with their parents, you know, going into their 30s. I mean, they're facing a generation that is completely different than what we did when we were growing up. So I think that that's going to come full circle around. And they're going to start to look at maybe libertarian policies, maybe more economic things, and how much are my taxes really costing me? And oh, by the way, where's it going? And what's the effect? And what's the result? And I think they're going to get serious very quickly when they get that first paycheck and they find out how much is taken out.
So you think Grandpa should hang on?
Yeah.
No, not necessarily. Well,
actually, I'm glad that you brought up Rand Paul because you know, to me, and again, longtime listeners will know is that. I have been a Rand Paul supporter for a long, long time, enthusiast. I said last year that when they got to the Final Four, I thought that Rand Paul would be one of those fighting for this nomination. And he's going nowhere. And I was under the perception that really the biggest supporter of and user of social media would be libertarians. So am I totally wrong with that, Bernard, that libertarians are not the dominant political philosophy? I'm hearing you say that liberals are the dominant political philosophy on Twitter and Facebook.
Yeah, no, libertarians are not the dominant presence on social media. A lot of the narrative is all centered around social justice, actually. So, I mean, I have a following of about 1,000 on Twitter. I see a lot of like.
Now, are they all tuned in tonight, Bernard? Did you let everybody know? Well, there we go. Well, so much for new media.
He has no answer for that.
We lost the signal.
The audio.
I don't know. Bernard, are you there? Audio wise, we lost the signal for the. Well, we're going to try it one more time. One of our other millennials is crawling around on the ground, trying to fix the hype. Anyway, you were making a point. Much ado about nothing.
No, I didn't. Don't overstate what I said. I still said that when it comes down to the nuts and bolts of a campaign, you still need a powerful ground game, voter contact, and a good message, and the ability to put out a good message rapidly. Which is, I think, that's where social media is actually more important than, you know, hey, are you going to this, or let's go to that, or let's get this done. But to have rapid response when an attack hits, to have the right kind of very quick 140 character message that sends people to the quote unquote truth or your message.
And as a way to reach your field team. If you put that together with a great field operation, I think that would be a significant asset.
I want to ask a question about Carly Fiorina. Why hasn't she taken off? She's had a couple of very good debates. One debate, she was the rock star winner. Everyone said, she put Donald Trump down. She put him in his place. She was soaring, and then she has fallen flat. What happened, in your view, Jeannie? Is it a gender thing? Is she being treated differently because she's a woman?
I just don't know that she's getting the media attention that maybe some of the other candidates are doing. I mean, it's all been Ben Carson this whole last week, correct? So nobody's really.
Yeah, but it's been for several weeks. You know.
And also, I'm not sure what she's been doing on the ground. I do know that she just started operations in Illinois. So she's already getting some delegates placed in Illinois. A friend of mine is one of the delegates. But that just started. So we haven't seen her. I haven't seen her in Illinois lately. She hasn't been to anything that I know about, any fundraisers or events. In fact, Trump, though, is showing up in Springfield, Illinois on Monday. That's a big deal for Illinois, apparently. I cannot figure that out either, other than the media is focused on other folks, and that's how we get our information as well.
But she didn't get a bounce out of the last debate.
No. Yeah, no,
I think
bounce at all.
I think
one of the few candidates that's never gotten a bounce out of a phenomenal debate.
The first time, you know, when she showed stared down Trump, and you know, but I think that she's had to answer for her tenure at Hewlett-Packard, and as more facts about that come out, her answers are not as strong, and she's having more difficulty there, and overall her level of experience on other topics isn't pushing
through.
I don't think we're buying it.
I mean, I think that to some degree in the last debate, she sounded kind of like the same talking points that we had heard in the previous two debates.
She wasn't fresh.
And so she was not fresh. That was my impression of her, and I tend to like her.
More doubles
than home
runs.
Very strong, and yeah.
Well, we got to pause. 1-800-723-8029. Got two more segments, and we got four more guests, four continued guests. I'll be back shortly.
This is Larry King at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Tonight, we've got a special guest for you to meet. What do you like to do as a kid?
I like to play baseball. I like to watch television.
What was your favorite sports team?
Sports team growing up was the St. Louis Cardinals.
What was your favorite vacation?
I think the vacation we went to New York City to the World's Fair. See Yankee Stadium.
Who was your childhood hero?
Childhood hero, probably Hopalong Cassidy.
What was your biggest fear growing up?
My biggest fear probably was that I would irritate my father.
What's the silliest thing you've ever done?
Irritated my father.
Give the gift of Larry King. Order your gift certificate now at museum.tv. That's museum.tv. Everyone back in Chicago, thank you very much for joining us this evening. One of our Democrats is Marge Halperin. She is here making her first visit, at least while I have been here. You've been
on
the show.
I've been on with Chris Roebling.
When Chris Roebling's been sitting in. And you work with Chris Roebling as a commentator for WGN television, Channel 9 News, which goes all over the country. And also, you were a well-known publicist and have been involved as a radio reporter, political activist in a variety of different ways. Nice to have you on the program this evening. We've known each other for a couple of months at least. Bruno Barrett also joins us. He is with the Heartland Institute. And also, he hails from the suburban western part
I live in the western suburbs,
western
now.
Suburbs
I grew
of Chicago.
River Forest. Northern suburbs, Illinois, born and raised, U of I, everything.
Johnny's Beef. Denny's Beef, the whole thing. Also with us is Phil Beverly. Phil Beverly is from Chicago State University, and he teaches campaigns and elections, has been a regular guest on this program for many, many years now. And Jeannie Ives has joined us. She is an Illinois State Representative. She's a Republican from Wheaton, Illinois. And again, we've been talking about Republican politics. And one name that we actually, I've got a couple of emails last week about, and they said, you never really talk about Ted Cruz other than when you say that he looks too much like Joe McCarthy and you don't think he's going to be elected president. I think he does remind me of Joe McCarthy in his mannerisms, not in his politics. And I don't think he will be elected president. I think he conceivably could be the Republican nominee, but I don't think he will be elected. But is he hasn't had his big moment. Is he maybe the smartest guy that's running and he's waiting until the right time to really charge through and run between Trump and Carson and go right down the middle and end up as a surprise winner either in Iowa? I don't think he's going to do well in New Hampshire, but he could be the big surprise in South Carolina, and then he could run the table in the South, maybe with the exception of Florida.
Look, conventional wisdom is always conventional, and then you have to worry about it. And I started off this election season with mostly conventional wisdom. Here's what I think is fascinating. First of all, to the extent that Cruz has had any kind of a big moment, it was in the last debate when he literally changed the entire tenor of the debate in a positive way for every single one of the GOP people up there by appropriately pointing out the tenor of all the questions and doing that. And it was actually a very, very good debate technique.
Brilliant way of doing it.
And if you listen to Alan Dershowitz and all the other people, I mean, the guy is a debate champion. I think the new conventional wisdom is that Kasich and Bush are toadies and they're gone and they're out, and that there's now people like Eric Erickson and the conservative blogosphere who are saying that what's going to happen is that things are going to break down to a Rubio versus Cruz race.
I think your first mistake is taking conservative writers as the conventional wisdom. But I think the second mistake is to think that bashing the media is that moment you're talking about. Yeah, it got some momentum, you know, because it's an easy hit. But when it comes time to look at the issues and be a weighty candidate, if you can't take the media hit, I don't think that's a good credential.
I'd like to really quickly respond to that.
Sure.
There is taking it too far. No one wants all 10 candidates to sit there and start whining about the media. And to some extent, you can see some of what Carson's doing being a little bit of that. But you haven't seen Cruz do that. And Cruz has come out with, very few people know this, but Cruz put out a flat tax with a VAT. I mean, he didn't call it a VAT because he's actually breaking convention on tax policy, and he's coming up with some very good stuff.
Go for it, Bruno. That's the best way to kiss off those minority, middle class, lower class voters that you were talking about earlier that you wanted. A flat tax, you can't get more regressive. Go for it.
You know, we can debate tax policy if you want to. I think it's something that's going to be looked at, and I think that you're going to see the Democratic candidates starting talking about this too.
By the way, the one thing on the Cruz point, Cruz's response, and where I think he stole the debate. I mean, he and Rubio both. Rubio did it first when he talked about the mainstream media is the pack of the Democratic Party, but in the Cruz case, Cruz had not been attacked. Cruz was not asked a real hardball question at that point. But he was again, standing up for other candidates, and he quickly recited chapter and verse how each of them had gone after some other candidate. So you're right. He was standing up for the group, not necessarily for himself, because he wasn't personally attacked at that particular point. And that was a sign of brilliance on my part. Do you think, again, would you acknowledge that Ted Cruz probably doesn't have a lot of support in Illinois? Jeannie, would you acknowledge that?
No, I'm not going to acknowledge that.
Okay.
At all. Ted Cruz hasn't worked in Illinois. He's focused very primarily on the first four primary states.
As well he should.
He has not set up an organization yet that I know of in Illinois. However, I do know that he's got consultants here because I recognize the name on the emails that come through to me. I like Ted Cruz, and I'm really not going to hide it. I think that when people listen to his message, when he gets the time to put out his message about who he is as a person and what he stands for, I think that resonates with a lot of people. And that's why I'm waiting for the actual field to winnow down to maybe a handful. Maybe there's four of them. And then we'll see where some of those other people go. And when the more that he gets to talk about who he is and his message and what his ideas are, I mean, look, he got elected in Texas. And Texas has its share of minority voting base as well. And he's a senator from Texas, and you can't discount that. The other thing about Ted Cruz is I think the very personal story that came out this week about how he support or his stepsister actually lost her life to overdose, and how he stepped in to support his nephew in that case. And, you know, and he used the credit card, too. He took out maxed out his credit card for $20,000 and sent that kid to a military type of school to help him through that tragedy and to give him some order and discipline in his life. And, you know, he helped recover from that. So, I mean, Ted Cruz is more than I think that the media has painted him out to be. And I think we've got a lot more to learn about this candidate. Biding his time.
Do you think that's what I'm saying?
He's waiting.
He's planning to peak at the right time. But is his candidacy, is it predicated on Carson and Trump falling, either one of them falling or both of them falling? Is that the road that he needs to take? Because he's not going to be fighting for the establishment.
The entire Republican Party's success is predicated upon Trump and Carson fading. I'm more conventional in this, but the fact of the matter is that they are outlier candidates who are benefiting from the typical Republican, anybody but a conventional candidate.
This is an outlier
election. Where Cruz, it is. I agree that it's become an outlier election. What is fascinating about Cruz is that he has played it so well that if those two candidates start to deflate, and I'm still guessing that they will, he is the one who is poised to benefit from it most, and Marco Rubio is the second one poised to benefit from it the most.
And I want to hear why you think that Rubio would be poised to benefit from it, because the way we look at it, we have 85 days to go to Iowa. I would be dumbfounded if Ben Carson does not win Iowa. I would be dumbfounded if he doesn't win Iowa.
But I
don't believe that Ben Carson is going to win or finish in the top three in New Hampshire. So there's going to be a split decision, and then you're going to go to South Carolina and Nevada, and that news is basically going to come at around the same time. And the rest of the way, with the exception of Florida, is probably Ted Cruz friendly. That's the Southern primaries, and then he gets into the Midwest primaries. Professor?
It seems strategically he could be biding his time, and yet he's got to worry about, does he have the staying power to bide his time with?
He's got a lot of money.
He'll need it.
Is the money in a super PAC
where we've now found out that it's completely worthless, or is the money actually in the campaign? Look, I don't really know where no one can predict how all of this stuff is going to break out. If Trump and Carson have staying power and actually start winning delegates, you are witnessing the breakup of the Republican coalition, which is much larger than most people would like to say it is. But you're looking at a split in the party.
Well, you saw it already in the whole debacle around the Speaker of the House. You can't play so far to the right that you lose your middle. I think you said that in the first 10 minutes of this show.
I don't think there was any debacle in the speaker. I mean,
yeah, I mean, it's really funny how different things.
He was a consensus candidate.
How many candidates?
After they had to fight down the Freedom Caucus. I mean, there was a lot of outcome
came together, and he was a consensus candidate.
Not right away,
that.
And there was a whole lot of infighting with the Freedom Caucus, and they got the head of Boehner first.
There's a narrative, and there's different narratives, and no one. And this is what's so interesting about my Twitter question to Bernard. You know, do we live in the world of narratives where it's like blah 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 blah,
right.
And you know, war
right.
on women, rape culture, and right. the narratives work sometimes, and then they fail other times.
Right.
But we're now living in this narrative that the Boehner situation was a debacle, when in fact you got rid of a guy who had actually been very very successful, and you had a big fight. And then you replaced him with the guy who literally, you know, when Paul Ryan came out with his budget, everybody went insane, and Boehner was against it, and everybody was against it. Now it's a budget. So they just had a budget deal that the conservatives are screaming was a failure, when in fact those two budget years that they just signed are actually below the spending level of what Ryan's original budget was. The Republicans are winning, and the entire party is becoming discombobulated because they're just so angry about everything. Take a deep breath and luxuriate in the fact that you're actually
it's
winning
nice
policy
to be in the minority
here.
This time. It's sort of good to be in the minority in the House this as you watch a party sort of try and eat itself. I just imagine a snake eating its tail. It's like, I'm not a Boehner fan, but the way he got taken out, I just...
Do you feel sorry for him?
I do, because what I saw him as was a politician who tries to get things done. And politics is the art of the possible. And you're going to have to compromise to get things done.
On the other hand, he fed the snake that ended up eating the tail.
Right.
So well, I don't know
what you ended up with. You ended up with a, as you said, you ended up with a consensus candidate who's very articulate, is on message, and is going to be a far greater representative of the broader Republican Party
than Kevin McCarthy.
It stands for
That's
than Kevin
right.
McCarthy Absolutely. Or John Boehner or Dennis Hastert. Back shortly from Chicago.
The beauty of Amlinks Interior Landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlinks now at 888-880-TREE.
Excuse me, Chet. Here is a flash from the Associated Press, Dateline Dallas. Two priests who were with President Kennedy say he is dead of bullet wounds.
It was a moment that defined American history. But what really happened in Dallas that day? And does that tragedy lead back to Chicago? A new play, Assassination Theater, answers that question. Now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. For tickets, go to assassinationtheater.com. Welcome. We're back on the air.
And
just as you said that, we just received a tweet.
It was a quote.
We just received a tweet.
Can't take this
Someone
out of
informing us that during the news break tonight, all of our comments during the news break were carried live on YouTube. And I was just warning everybody about watch what you say, and we come back on the air, and you're calling someone an animal.
I was quoting.
Well, I know, but you know what? The people at home didn't hear that. Well, they just heard you say, you know.
Which is why I didn't use the pejorative of the word.
Well, that's good.
I'm always very careful.
You're always careful. Be very careful. Okay. Let's go right around the table, and let's spend a moment about Hillary Clinton. Is it all over? Is the Democratic primary all over, Marge Halpern?
Oh, I think any candidate who takes that attitude this early in the race is making a grave error. And as a supporter of the Clinton campaign, I would never say that that was true. I think there's a lot to play out. Will she emerge the winner of the nomination? I think so, and I think she should. I think she's the candidate who has the broadest appeal, who has the most experience on the Democratic side. Well, on either side, I would say I could defend that across the general election. But to say it's over now is to make a mistake. She's running hard, and she needs to.
Absolutely.
Professor, you agree?
And she, I think Bernie Sanders actually helps her because it's real competition and she has to sharpen her message and really stay on her game. If there was no one else running, she'd get no media attention, obviously, because she would need it.
She's not getting a lot now compared to the rest of
mm-hmm.
the
yeah. Right.
And I think she's just the presumptive nominee, but she's still getting tested, which is important.
That's what a campaign's for.
Well, we'll just have to wait and see what the FBI says about everything in the end here.
It's easy to raise that specter, but
no, I mean,
nothing
is ever. I think she's in trouble. I think that this FBI director is not as politicized as the Justice Department is. And I think she's got some concerns about whether or not, I mean, everybody knows that she had classified information and lots of it on her private server. And
everybody
that is a problem.
Doesn't know
anybody
that.
Else would be in jail by now.
Everybody doesn't know that. There's no there.
I would essentially say it's all over but the voting. I mean, obviously, Marge is correct that you never act as if you're there unless you're Jim Oberweis. But the fact of the matter is that it's interesting that you've got, quote-unquote, successful governors like Jerry Brown. You've got Mark Warner, who's actually one of the few people successful in the Democratic Party who's under 70. Or 65 or something. And the farm team has been decimated by the 1,000 Democratic seats that have been lost since Barack Obama took the presidency. But the fact of the matter is that the fact that there's this coronation of someone who is so clearly part of a flawed machine and that the Democratic Party has become so corporatized and yet is at the same time rushing left as fast as it can on its left flank. It's going to be an interesting year, and this idea that the Democrats are going to win based on demographics and all these other things, I think there's a lot of things that have still left to break out. But Hillary Clinton will beat either Donald Trump or Ben Carson. I will make that prediction.
Do you agree with that, Jeannie?
I completely disagree.
Well, let's hear it.
Yeah.
Cage fight, Republicans.
That's right. It's a Republican primary.
Pay-per-view.
I'm sure that's what we're talking
Hillary's
about. I disagree with you as well. Go ahead.
Hillary's favorables are in the tank. I mean, nobody trusts her on any poll that you talk about. You know, she's actually not doing well there at all. In fact, if it were Bill Clinton, hey, you know, his favorables are up there compared to his wife. But, you know, I think that people don't trust her. I think that her investigation is still a question mark. And I think Trump or Carson could beat her because they are different. And people are looking for somebody different, somebody who is authentic and honest. And that's the last thing that Hillary Clinton is.
I don't think Trump or Carson have proved themselves to be either of those things at the moment.
Well, they are different.
Honest or authentic.
Tell me why you think Trump is dishonest and not authentic. I think he may be the most authentic person out there.
Well, he's changed so many of his positions once he ran for office on the Republican ticket. He was for a lot of liberal things, single payer, and a lot of other things.
But
that's an authentic change.
As a person, I mean, I don't think he's someone that's coached. I don't think he's someone that's, you know, been briefed on anything, obviously.
Because he's not coachable.
He's not
coachable. He's a marketing character. He's a product of marketing.
He has a swagger and confidence.
I gotta say,
Bruce, and you and I are probably clearly in disagreement on this. I mean, I think Donald Trump is, and he would even admit it, he is a self-created media creation. How you can call a media creation authentic, and this is, I have been teasing and arguing with my Republican friends day in and day out on this kind of stuff. I mean, the guy is the least authentic politician in the world, and I don't know who that is at this moment, is more authentic than any celebrity media creation. Any celebrity media creation.
Wait a minute, but what is the media creation? He's a strong shoot from the lip guy who calls things as he sees them. He doesn't seem to put a finger in his hair in the air to worry about what he's in his
right.
hair or
right.
or saying it.
Right.
And again, he's been around doing that for a long time. He's a billionaire. He was born with a silver spoon in his mouth. He lives in a beautiful building. He is surrounded by beautiful women. He's been married 3 times. He has a beautiful family. What is not authentic about it? Now, you may not like his arrogance.
I don't think we do.
I don't think we like his some of about him, but the problem, but he is who he is, and people
know it.
That's my point. That's the point. And
which makes him authentic.
And the perception, if the media created him, whatever, it's still the perception that that is who he is.
We don't know.
Perception is reality.
Perception. 4 years ago, he was lecturing the Republican Party on how we had to have a comprehensive immigration bill. This year, he wants to build a wall and make the Mexicans pay for it. Issue by issue and all this other stuff, that the idea that you can change your opinions on that kind of stuff and then call somebody authentic.
No. What I would say is what you're describing is flip-flopism. And that goes...
That's true.
Everyone has a little bit of flip-flop
sure.
in them.
They're politicians.
But authentic, I don't think you could say he's not authentic.
If what you're saying
you
is...
Like,
I will take it under advisement.
You know why I like to go to California? Because when I go to California, I breathe that air, and you know what? It's real plastic. I like real plastic, and you can find real plastic in California. On that note, we are out of...
Are you headed to Los Angeles? Looking for the ideal place for you and your family to relax and enjoy yourselves? A place that combines a 4-diamond hotel experience with a convenient location? It's the Hilton Los Angeles Universal City, just steps away from Universal Studios Hollywood, CityWalk, and NBC Studios. Just a short ride to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, TCL Chinese Theater, Warner Brothers, and other popular attractions. Enjoy spacious rooms offering breathtaking views and a world-class Las Vegas-style seafood and prime rib buffet every weekend and holidays. Share family fun and enjoy the oasis of the palm tree-lined pool and whirlpool. Relax in your own private poolside cabana with a cocktail or snack at your fingertips. Book your reservation today at HiltonUniversal.com or call 1-800-774-1500. The Hilton, Los Angeles, Universal City at HiltonUniversal.com. They let you be the star in Hollywood.
The beauty of Amlinks Interior Landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlinks now at 888-880-TREE.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be, where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
Roosevelt.
Excuse me, Chet. Here is a flash from the Associated Press, Dateline Dallas. Two priests who were with President Kennedy say he is dead of bullet wounds.
It was a moment that defined American history. But what really happened in Dallas that day? And does that tragedy lead back to Chicago? A new play, Assassination Theater, answers that question. Now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. For tickets, go to assassinationtheater.com.